WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
My guest is Liz Carpenter. In the 1960s, she was press secretary to First Lady Lady Bird Johnson. Before that, Liz Carpenter was executive assistant to Lyndon Johnson when he was vice president. She was one of the first women to hold such a post. It was Carpenter who wrote the 58-word text that Johnson read the evening President Kennedy was assassinated. When she worked for Mrs. Johnson, Carpenter saw her role as finding a way to help her help him. Liz Carpenter came to Washington from Texas in 1945 as a 21-year-old, $25-a-week reporter for a Washington news service. She worked for the Washington Bureau of several Texas newspapers before starting the Carpenter News Service with her husband. After her husband's death in 1974, Carpenter moved back to Texas. She later became active in women's rights issues. She was one of the founders of the National Women's Political Caucus and has lobbied actively for passage of the ERA. Liz Carpenter has written a memoir, a book she says started when she was 65, her Medicare birthday. The book is titled Getting Better All the Time, and it's published by Simon & Schuster. Welcome to Fresh Air.
Thank you, Terry.
You say at the beginning of your book that a death of someone you love can shelve you. That didn't really happen to you, at least not for long. I know you went through a terrible period of grief, but what helped you get back on your feet?
Well, I think the words of a woman who came up to me, and I had that drained look that so many widows have for a while after the wrestling with all the gamut of emotions that you go through as you lose someone. And she took my hands and she said, "You've got to start thinking of it as a chance at a second life." And those words really jarred me, and I began to see it in different eyes. I think that also reading some things about what other women had done to recover was helpful. And one of the things was, strangely enough, to entertain, to fill your house with people. And there was a time when my home seemed most empty, and that was every weekend, because that was the time my husband and I had shared. And so I started forcing myself to plan a Sunday night supper for friends and to make myself use the good china and go get the pretty flowers and make it special. And that kept me occupied psychologically and mentally and physically, going and marketing. And it really was therapeutic. And somebody was going to be coming into the house Sunday night.
You know what, I think one of the tricks might be too to not allow people to feel sorry for you, because I think when someone loses a spouse, there's people, you feel so bad for the person that you maybe almost don't even want to see them because you can't bear the thought of so much pain.
Friends do avoid you, but I think you have to put on a happy face, so to speak, and not expose yourself to people who are congenital complainers, to not just make your friends a ring of widows, because you'll find that everybody's going to spend a little bit of time talking about the person they were married to, and that's no good. Naturally, you know, our age group, we know lots of widows. I know lots of widows, but I don't want to be isolated to one category.
You were lucky enough to have had a political life and a life as a journalist beforehand, and you had causes to throw yourself into after
and
your And
they were
death.
A big salvation, because it takes you outside yourself. You get your mind off yourself. And whether it's sick kittens or saving a restored part of the city, anything, and whether it takes a little bit of money to join something, you really need to do that.
To get
into something that isn't just inside you.
You really, I think, stepped up your activism in the women's rights movement. You'd already been very active in it before your husband's death. But you know what I'm wondering about your activism in feminism? Some successful women of your generation didn't become actively involved in the women's movement, and they felt, well, I made it. What's the problem? I mean, I made it. Why can't other women do it? But you obviously didn't feel that way.
Oh, I think that that's a very selfish way to look at it. It seems to me the whole effort should be networking. And it seems to me that one of the things that I could do was to cast my bread back on the waters for doors that might have opened for me. But I'd always wanted women to be able to achieve as a reporter. I would be interviewing a lot of them. And so that it prodded me on to try to help other women by giving something of myself and a little bit of the establishment. I was a little bit more respectable than many of the women who were out in the streets. I had worked in the establishment in politics, and I was happy to share that identity and laughter, wit, which I'm blessed with having a gift of, I hope. And we needed to laugh at ourselves, Terry. We took ourselves too seriously at first because we were so intent, and there was not as much laughter. And laughter is a very winning trait. We win friends with it.
When you started getting involved in the ERA and when you became a co-founder of the National Women's Political Caucus, did you look back on the men who you work with during your political career and start to react differently toward them? And I'm thinking maybe of John F. Kennedy, Lyndon Baines Johnson. Did you review their actions in a different light after you became a feminist activist?
Any consciousness raising makes you review and see things that you didn't see before. I didn't do it in anger. I thought both of them were fabulous, and both of them had many pluses on their side as far as women are concerned. But they still were part of that kind of old mold where you were more comfortable in a circle of men. Now, Johnson, not so much as Jack Kennedy. Jack Kennedy grew up in a background where it really was kind of Boston male-oriented. Johnson was out of the Southwest, where a lot of the pioneers were male and female, and they were strong types down there. And he was much more at home with women, I think, and willing to take on their cause, although we were just at the very beginning of this. And he didn't take it on as much as Betty Ford or as much as Jimmy and Rosalind Carter. Of course, now we have a stalemate because nobody is shouting about ERA from the White House. They're against it.
You started your career as a journalist.
Yes.
And then you moved into politics. This is a career change that I think a lot of journalists go through. There's a bit of a revolving door between politics and journalism. Did you feel like you were turning your back on your profession when you went into politics?
No, I didn't, because I was answering the questions instead of asking them. But in a way, I wondered if I could go back and recapture, you know, the talent of writing words into a story and not just putting them in a press release or writing a speech. And that didn't turn out to be a major problem. One of the things I did worry about was my husband and I had had a news bureau in Washington, and kind of a round-the-clock marriage and marvelous conversation about what was going on. And so I did miss that some, but he encouraged me very much to take on this new challenge of working for Lyndon Johnson. And so I did it.
My guest is Liz Carpenter, who was an assistant to Lyndon Johnson when he was a vice president and then became press secretary to Lady Bird Johnson when she was first lady. She's an activist in the women's rights movement and the author of a new memoir titled Getting Better All the Time. You wrote LBJ's speech after, was a short speech, after the Kennedy assassination.
Yes.
That must have been a very difficult thing to write. I mean, who would know what to say after a national tragedy of that magnitude?
You know, it came, and I cannot say it came from in me. It came from above, genes, something. But somehow at the time of a terrible day, you're called upon to be a survivor. And my role had been being a writer, writing remarks for LBJ. And so as we were moving out of Dallas to Air Force One, somehow my hand went into my purse, pulled out a pencil and a pad, knowing as a reporter that I had been, that I would, that he would be faced with a battery of reporters when we stepped off the plane in Washington, and he'd need some words. And so the words just began to come, and I don't think I rewrote them. I think that they just came, and without any real conscious effort, and I can't help but feel they were God-given. And this was true also, I think, to other people. All of us were moving around in a sort of a trauma. We still trying to reject what had happened. And I remember the two wire service reporters just automatically moved to telephones at Parkland Hospital and grabbed the phones. But that's their profession telling them more than any conscience effort. The White House photographer knew he had to have the picture of the swearing in, and he set about doing that. So you kind of went about your work in a trance.
You started that message for Johnson with a very simple and very moving line. You wrote, "This is a sad time for all people."
Yes.
What did you open with that?
I started thinking this is a sad time for all Americans, but Kennedy was beloved around the world, and so it seemed to be too limiting.
So you came up with, "This is a sad time
for all Americans and for all people," and then I asked your help and God's at the end.
You became Lady Bird's press secretary, and you say you saw the job as helping her help him, of helping the First Lady help the president.
That encompasses everything, yeah. Doesn't it?
Well, but I wonder, what can you really do as the press secretary for the First Lady? What's your best way of helping the president?
Well, by making her his translator, and he deserved one, and a president is terribly busy doing their things, and Lady Bird could go out and walk through the Head Start projects in Newark, New Jersey, or the Job Corps in Kentucky, and she had been a reporter herself briefly, but she had been a trained journalist with a Bachelor of Journalism degree from the University of Texas. So she really knew what the 5 W's and the H are. She knew the difference between an AM and a PM. And if she could go and help kind of be the catalyst that brought out the story of what the kids in Head Start were like before and after the program, it certainly was helpful in selling the program to Congress and to the people.
How did the duties divide between the presidential press secretary and the First Lady press secretary?
Well, I briefly said I took care of women's dogs and old brocades. Previous press secretaries had sometimes been annoyed that they had to answer questions about the animals at the White House, the feature story side of the White House. But it was the family side of the White House, anything that encompassed the children, the daughters, the dogs, the questions about, the restoration of a room or the purchase of a new piece of furniture was my department. They stuck to, on the president's side of the White House, the issues.
What were some of the greatest crises that you had to cope with as press secretary to the First Lady?
Well, two that kind of dropped in on me were the weddings of the two daughters. And this is because I'm not by nature a press spokesman about weddings, but I was thrust into that. And there were about 85 to 100 women reporters who were eager to know every tedious detail about the plans for the weddings. And it was a joyous kind of relief, I think, from the steady barrage of stories about Vietnam that were certainly full of our front pages. And all the world does love a lover, so romance was ripe in the White House, and that was some of it. That you would get cornered on small things like, did Lucy's wedding gown have a union label in it? And this would be drop out of the sky. You didn't even know, and you have to find out, did it? And if it didn't, it better.
I bet a sense of humor would help disarm strange or hostile questions.
Absolutely. And so during those series of briefings every day on what was happening in the last 2 weeks of the wedding, I'd try to find a button that would say Marine power when Linda was marrying a Marine, or some other kind of thing that was typical of the day, or to give them a taste of the sampling of the wedding cake we were going to have. Laughter helps a lot on anything when you're in a tense situation, and it served presidents very well, you know.
Well, you actually were the head of a round table to come up with jokes for
humor lines.
LBJ.
Yes. Well, I have like to write humor, Terry. And so he asked me, he'd say, Liz, sex up this speech. And by sex up, he didn't mean it in the basic content of the words. He meant make the first of it, the introduction of it, humorous so people will relate and you'll get going into the speech. And so I got together some of the best writers around the White House. Peter Benchley, who later went on to write Jaws, Jack McNulty, who later went on to be vice president of General Motors, Harry Middleton, who's head of the LBJ Library, and an array of them. And we'd gather together once a week, I think it was a Thursday afternoon, and sit in my office and think, what is topical that you could write humor about today? And it just was a way to improve LBJ's personal mood, I think, and second, to win listeners who would. Johnson was not a great speech maker, I don't think. I think the words were fabulous, and there were times he was magnificent, but most of the time he really had too much of a steady voice that did not have enough variety in it. And so when he could get the playback from his audience of a laugh or something, suddenly he'd become more of a ham, and that helped him.
Can you remember any of the openers that you came up with that you were
proudest
of?
Well, let me see. Oh, you're pressing me. I know that at the when he did his last swan song before the National Press Club, he said, you know, everybody criticized him for showing his scar after he had the gallbladder operation. That was very Johnsonian, not that he wanted to show his scar, but when a reporter said that he wanted to see it, he just shared it. Well, the cameras clicked, of sorts. Of course, and he was widely criticized, and it made him furious. Well, on that last day in office, he said, you know, they asked me, what have you got to show for your presidency, Mr. President? And so I showed my scar. That's what I had. And he took some of the things that had been flaws in his administration and criticized and, you know, leveled with the press and made light of them. Gerald Ford had an arm-around-the-shoulder humor that would lighten the load very much after Watergate, I think.
My guest is Liz Carpenter. She's a women's rights activist and a former press secretary to First Lady Lady Bird Johnson. She's written a memoir titled Getting Better All the Time. We'll talk some more after this short break. This is Fresh Air. Liz Carpenter is my guest. She's written a new memoir. It's titled Getting Better All the Time. When you were first secretary to Lady Bird Johnson, I'm sure that there were plenty of times when she was out on one of her beautification campaigns when she was met by anti-war demonstrators and when that became a part of the story that the press covered. Actually, I'm sure you must have run into that a lot, where anti-war demonstrations were receiving more coverage than the message that you and she wanted to get out. What was your stand on the war then?
Well, after 1966, when things began to get worse in Vietnam and you were getting more demonstrators, well, that's when the signs began to go up. And she would be out trying to tell not just about beautification, but about many other things like the war on poverty. And suddenly these signs would appear and the newswomen would just and the picture would be the sign. All you did was try to plead with them. You could not manage their news, but you would try to hope that somehow the story of the Job Corps camp, of the boy that had been improved by it, would get in. But often it was taken away from you, and that made it very difficult and discouraging. But she still kept on keeping on.
Was it ever hard for you in that administration to be in a position of defending the war?
Well, I never was in that area of competency, so to speak, and people didn't expect me to do that. I certainly heard plenty of blasts at Johnson because of it, but I was not handling foreign policy, and so I can't really say that anyone tried to pin me down. It did make my job more difficult simply because it was, you know, when your boss is being criticized, it's not easy.
As you pointed out, the press secretary, the First Lady, frequently covers the family issues, and First Lady's issues are frequently involved in things like beautification campaigns or
causes.
Yeah. Do you think that, as a feminist now, do you think that the First Lady could take a more activist position than first ladies have traditionally taken? Do you think maybe the job should change or is changing?
Well, she is not elected by anybody but one person, her husband. And so I think that the public will resent too much visible interference. But on the other hand, I give our first ladies the right of all the options. If they want to stay on the second floor and do needlepoint, that is their right, and there's no requirement, no job requirement. I don't think they'll enjoy it. I don't think that they will take advantage of a podium, a sort of podium they have from the White House. But they ought to choose something that comes naturally. And with Lady Bird, the love of the landscape and what we can do about it was very much true to her heart and her desires. So it sold itself. She's still at it at almost 75 years old with the National Wildflower Research Center. But I think it seems alien when you pick something that doesn't come naturally just to have a cause per se.
You found out that Johnson was resigning, like most of us did, by watching television.
Yeah,
you saw his speech, and later learned that his speech had two endings, one in which he resigned and one in which he didn't.
That's the one I'd read earlier that afternoon.
The one in which he didn't resign. Well, did you feel angry that you had to find out about this from television?
Not at all. I went right down to the White House. A Lady Bird called me and said they'd wanted to tell me, and they made a point of calling staff real quickly after the broadcast so you wouldn't have this. But I was sorry that he decided not to, because I think that, we went into the Nixon period, and so... and ultimately Watergate. But it would have been tough for him to get reelected because, as he realized, he was not the person to rally people together when everyone was so divided on Vietnam.
You went into politics as a former journalist.
Yes.
Was your opinion of journalism changed by being on the other end? Because as a political press secretary, it was your job to try to get out certain information and to manage the news. You had been on the receiving end of that beforehand. And it seems to me there's this implicit distrust that a lot of journalists have toward press secretaries and that many press secretaries have towards journalists.
So, I think I'm less hard-nosed about political reporting than I was before. I realize more of the pressures on a political figure than I did before. I guess that if I went back being a journalist, I would see the public figure with a little more perception. I know we do batter our candidates pretty much, and some of them deserve it, but we do batter our candidates, and that's why a dreadful thing is happening in the country, and that we make it so tough to run for office and so costly that we're losing out on some of the cream of the crop.
Do you distrust journalists or politicians more than you did before?
Oh, that comes a little with age, but I also know that there are voices out there that are very strong and very right. I know I my natural inclination is to like people in public life, and both journalists and reporters are, because I'm fascinated with politics. And so the people who are participating on either side of the pad and pencil are people that I like to talk to.
Liz Carpenter is my guest, and she's written a memoir titled Getting Better All the Time. As we mentioned before, you started this memoir when you were 65, and it was around 11 years after your husband died. And somewhere in the book you write, "At my age, the circle of men to marry is practically zero level, yet I am more interesting and have more time. But who wants to nurse an aging man? It's too late for marriage." I was surprised to hear you say that.
Well, maybe I shouldn't have said it, but I think that at this time of life, you think, I don't know, my health may be frail. Generally, you have some kind of ailment, something in what I call the parts department. You're losing a knee or an eye or a bosom, and yet I might want to retract that statement because some marvelous romance has come into my life.
Really?
And it came in at the time I had a mastectomy this year. And so I've I'm not interested in marriage. I am interested in romance, and it was very therapeutic. And an old friend came back into my life that I'd known 47 years ago at the University of Texas. We're the same age.
Why romance but not marriage? Is it
Well, I think that I'm not a good bet for anybody since I have cancer in my background, and I think that well, now, I don't know. That's kind of a tough question. But I think at this point also, Terry, I don't want to change my books. I've just gotten all the bookkeeping straight in the process of widowhood. I have a neighbor who doesn't want to mess up her tennis games. And so marriage is not so much the end of the road here. And I think that I would much rather just enjoy somebody's company occasionally than and to have the breathing room of the independence that I've come to know and enjoy some of.
You think the legal and financial arrangements in a marriage later in life
Yes.
are much more complicated than they are earlier
They
on?
They are. I know that it takes quite a contract to get it all straightened out. But I think that I have a total understanding about that with the person I know and like. And we just like each other's company, and life has been fuller and happier for us since we've known each other.
And at this point in your life, it wouldn't bother you to have intimate relations and not be officially married?
Well, that's a question that I'd rather not answer.
Oh, fine.
I don't think it would bother me, but it's romance I'm looking for.
Okay, well, I really wish you the best.
And thank you so much.
Very much for joining us. You wanted to read part of a poem. Let me ask you to read that before we have to end.
There is a poem called Come the Dawn, written by a woman from New York, and it really does discuss what most people have gone through in learning to live alone. So you plant your own garden and decorate your own soul instead of waiting for someone to bring you flowers. And you learn that you really can endure, that you really are strong, and you really do have worth. And you learn and learn. With every goodbye, you learn. And, of course, that's the constructive side of grief. If you can learn and learn and then blossom again, that's the answer.
With that, Liz Carpenter, I want to thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you, Terry.
For being here. My guest has been Liz Carpenter. She's an active women's rights activist, a co-founder of the National Women's Political Caucus, former press secretary to Lady Bird Johnson. She's written a memoir titled Getting Better All the Time, and it's published by Simon & Schuster. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.